Turn back, if you would, to Hebrews chapters 1 and 2, where we're going to begin this evening. Our goal is really here to trace what the writer of Hebrews is saying and to try to follow along, as it were, with his sermon. And in his sermon, basically, there are four different things that he puts forward. He puts forward facts. He puts forward or he raises objections and then answers them. A good speaker does that, anticipates objections that the listeners are going to have, raises them, and then answers those objections. He has several warnings, and then he has several lines of exhortation. So as we go through the book, I'm going to try to point those out. He'll make a point, and then he'll build on those points. He'll raise an objection and answer it, and then he might have a warning and then also an exhortation. And we find several of those even in this passage this evening. Again, as I mentioned, he's writing to Hebrews. He's writing to Jews. These are people who are undergoing persecution, who are undergoing difficulty. And again, their temptation is to say, you know, ever since I put my faith in Jesus as the Messiah, I've had nothing but trouble. Maybe I'll just go back to worshiping God the way my ancestors have done for 1,500 years, and I don't need to worry about Jesus. I'll just go back to Judaism. That will take care of the persecution problem, and I'll just do that. And the writer of Hebrews is saying, you can't go back. God has given new revelation. He's revealed himself in the person of his Son, and therefore, if you turn back from his Son, you will face his Son in judgment. So let's look at what he has to say here. In the first four verses, really, the fact is this. The Son, God's Son, is better than God's prophets. He says, God has spoken to the fathers by prophets in many times, many ways, many different ways. That's really talking about the whole Old Testament. This is God speaking, God revealing himself. And the writers weren't people who had made up their religion. They weren't people who were godless heathens. They were people who were standing in a stream of revelation from God, and it comes all the way back, as you could look back centuries earlier, that these people were people to whom God had spoken. But he says God did speak that way by the prophets, but verse 2, in these last days he's spoken by a son, by his Son. And that is so much more significant than these prophets. These prophets were God's mouthpieces. They spoke what God told them to speak. But he says in these last days God has spoken by a son. Now, this is much more significant, because look at what he goes on to say about this son in verse 2. He's appointed him the heir of all things. Right? He's the one to whom everything belongs. It is his. It says also he's the creator, through whom also he created the world. And in verse 2. Verse 3, look at what it says about his essence. He's the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. He is God. God's Son is God. And furthermore, besides just having the right to own this universe and the one who created it and the one who is God, he also upholds it. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. So just as God spoke the world, the universe into existence, he maintains the world by his very word. Then it goes on to say something about the Son, and this again is something that could be said of none of the prophets, of none of the angels. He says he made purification for sins and he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Now, that statement is full of a lot of things that should make us say, he did what? That doesn't mean a lot to us that we say this, but you don't walk into a king's presence and sit down, you know, just kind of pull up a chair and, so, king, how are you doing? You know, we don't have kings in our country, and that's fine, but you don't sit in front of the king. You stand before the king. The king sits, you stand. You don't pull up a chair. And you certainly don't sit down at his right hand. This is a position of honor and authority. You don't just take that position for yourself. You don't say, you know, I think I'm just going to sit over here. Looks like there's an empty spot over there. I'll go sit there. This is something that he does because of who he is. Because he is God's Son. Because he is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Jesus Christ, after he made purifications for sin, he went into the throne of God and he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Verse 4, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. And here's what he's saying about the name that the angels have and the name that Jesus Christ has. The name isn't so much like hello, my name is, but it's his title. All right? And he's going to go on and say in just a moment or two, the second fact is, the Son is better than the prophets because he is the heir of all things. He created the world. He maintains the world. But he's greater than the angelic beings. All right? And he is because the title that the angels have and the title that Jesus Christ has is different. The angel's title on their business card, it says the angel Gabriel, and then underneath it says servant, right? God's servant. And on Jesus, it says Jesus the Christ, God's son. All right? So a son is better than the angelic servants. Now, when we read this, we say, where is he going with this angel stuff? Like, I don't understand why that's such a big deal. Let me explain why it's a big deal. First of all, he's comparing faith in Jesus Christ to Old Testament Judaism. How did they find out about what? Where is all the truth of Old Testament worship contained? It's in the Old Testament scriptures that were revealed by God through prophets. What is the start of this Old Testament religion? Well, it's the law. And where did the law come from? Well, it was given by God to Moses at Mount Sinai. Now, in the understanding of the Old Testament and referred to several times in the New Testament by Stephen in Acts chapter 7 and by Paul in Galatians chapter 3 and here and again in chapter 2 by the writer of Hebrews, the understanding was that God wrote on these tablets of stone, then he gave them to angels who delivered them to Moses. Right? So the law came from God by the hand of angels. That was their understanding. So he's saying, first of all, okay, Jesus Christ is superior to the prophets through whom God revealed his word. Jesus Christ is superior to the angels who delivered God's law to man, to Moses. And in the next chapter, spoiler alert, he's going to say Jesus Christ is superior to Moses, who was a faithful servant, but Jesus is a faithful son. All right, so the son is superior to angelic servants. Look at what he says here. He says he has inherited a name that's more excellent than theirs, or a title. They are servants, servant of God. Now, that is a worthy designation, but it pales in comparison to son of God. Right? Now he's going to go to the Old Testament, and he's going to make his point. Right? He says, you want to talk Old Testament? You want to trade proof texts? Let's do it. He says this, to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? Answer? None of them, all right? Their title is servant, not son. Okay? Which of the angels did he ever say, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son? None of them. Okay? That's what God said to his son. And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. Now, if you look up this verse that it's referencing in your English Bible, you say, that doesn't say the same thing. Again, the writer of Hebrews is quoting from the Septuagint, and it does say that. And that is his understanding. And he says, the angels worship God. He calls the angels to worship God's Son. So which one is superior? Clearly, in his mind, it is the Son. Now, what is the title? What is the name that the angels have inherited? He says, he makes his angels winds and his ministers, there's your a flame of fire. So what are they? They are ministers. They are servants. So Jesus, the Son, is superior to the angels, the servants. What does he say about the Son? Well, he quotes two passages here, extended passages, but they're both significant because of how he addresses the Son. What is the name which the Son has inherited? What is the name by which God the Father addresses the Son? Verse 8, of the Son he says, your throne, O God. Go back and read that. That is a fascinating passage back there in Psalm chapter 45. Because what he does is he says, he calls him God, and then he says down farther in verse 9, therefore God, your God, has anointed you, God. It's very similar to Psalm 110, where the Lord, Jehovah, says to my Lord, sit here until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. And here he addresses the Son as God. And verse 10 and following, again, how does he address him? He says, you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Who is the one he's just gotten done who said, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of his hands? Well, he just said back in verse 2, through Jesus Christ, he created the world. and he says, "You, Lord." Did he say that to any of the angels? Answer, no. The name that they, the title that the Son has inherited is more excellent than the title of angelic servant. And to which of the angels, verse 13, has he ever said, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet"? Answer, none. To whom did he say that? He said that to the Son. And then, verse 14, he says this, "Are they not all ministering spirits?" That's kind of a play on verse 7. He makes his angels winds, winds being the same word in Hebrew as spirits, and his ministers a flame of fire. They are ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation. So there's the second fact is that the Son is better than the angelic servants, better than the angels, superior to the angels through whom the law was mediated. Now, he's going to take a break from that, and he's going to issue a warning. And this is how several of his warnings work out. His warning is this. Under the Old Testament law, if you disobeyed, there were very specific and severe punishments. And they would have all agreed with that. Yes, this is true. How much, if that was what God had, the punishments that God gave but through the prophets mediated by angels, how much more severe the punishment that God would mete out for the one who turned their back on his Son? Right? If God punished those who disobeyed the word given by angels and by prophets, how would God treat those who turned their back on his Son? Look at verse chapter 2, verse 1. "Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard." Notice first person plural. All right, he's including himself in this. "We must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it." All right. Now, this idea of drifting is kind of like, you know, you pull the boat up, but you don't tie it, and then you look around, and all of a sudden the boat's way out, and you're like, "Oh no, I lost the boat. It drifted away. I didn't notice it. It wasn't like, you know, as soon as I stepped out of it, it went over there. It was like it just slowly moved away." And he says, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard. We need to listen. We need to focus. This is a repeated admonition through the book of Hebrews is consider, think about, pay closer attention. Focus your mind on this. So what is it that he's telling him that we must focus our minds on what we have heard? Well, I think what he's saying we focus our minds on is the superiority of Jesus Christ. The fact that we've just sung about several things about who Jesus Christ is, about how blessed his name is, about how his ascended glory and his coming glory will eclipse everything. That we must pay much closer to this superior one, this Jesus that he's talking about. Otherwise, if we drift away from it, he says this, "For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution," he's talking about the Old Testament law. If you don't believe me, go back and read it. There's all sorts of just retributions for every transgression or disobedience. Okay? If God punished those who disobeyed his revelation via prophets and angels, how much more, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? What is this great salvation? The salvation that he offers in his Son. How will we survive if we turn our backs on God's Son? He says, this salvation was declared at first by the Lord, by Jesus himself. I could think of several things that he said, such as, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me." He says, it was attested to us by those who heard, which makes sounds to me that he was not one of the apostles. The writer says it was attested to us by those who heard. And God bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles that these were actually the true words. If this was the one in whom we must believe, Jesus of Nazareth, the Christ, he said so himself. His apostles backed that up. God bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. So if God did that, and if God is placing this value upon this revelation through his Son, he's spoken in times past many ways, many times through prophets, he mediated his law through angels, but now he's speaking in a Son. And if those who disobeyed the revelation given by angels or prophets were punished, how much more those who turn their back on the revelation via his Son? There's a warning there. Now, he's going to continue, and he's going to do, I think, what a good speaker does, and that's anticipate an objection. And there's going to be two objections. His first objection is this. Now, if Jesus, the Christ, is God's Son, and you're saying that he is, how is he superior to angels? Because he came as a human being. He was a human being. He was a man who was attested to us by those who heard. There was those who saw him. We talked with him. We heard stories about him. Maybe some of these people had actually physically interacted with Jesus. He was a man, and we know that human beings are not superior to angels, right? That's the question. How could Jesus, as a human being, be superior to the angels? And the writer of Hebrews is going to go back to the Old Testament, Psalm chapter 8, 8th Psalm. He says, "For it is not to angels that God subjected the world to come." In other words, who is the one who's going to be ruling the world to come? Is it going to be the angels? No. It's going to be God's Son. And, furthermore, us. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 says, "Do you not know that we will judge angels?" All right. But he says, it wasn't the angels that God subjected the world to come of which we're speaking. And then he goes to this passage. Now, when I read Psalm 8, it sounds like he's talking about human beings. They're a little lower than the angels, right? What is man that you're mindful of him? Son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. But the writer of Hebrews goes back to the Septuagint, and he pulls out a piece here, and he says, it's not so much that he was a little lower than the angels, but the significance, he was made for a little while lower than the angels. And our English Standard Version does a good job of translating that. That's his point, is that he wasn't in essence lower than the angels, but for a temporary time, he was humbled and he subjected himself to God, and he was made for a while lower than the angels. So here's his point, is that he says, you made him for a little while lower than the angels. So yes, Jesus Christ was humbled, and he was, as a human being, but this was temporary. And he goes on to quote from the psalm again, you've crowned him with glory and honor and putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, he says, you look around, you say, I don't see everything in subjection under Jesus' feet yet. There's coming a day. There is coming a day. We're looking forward to that, when every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess. But what we see is Jesus, verse 9, who was for a little while made lower than the angels, but lower than the angels no more. Now he is the one who has sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. The one who is to whom God says, you are my son. The one to whom God says, worship him, all you angels. This is the Jesus about whom we're talking, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. So objection number one is, doesn't the fact that he became a human being mean that he's inferior to angels? And the answer is no. His humiliation was temporary. It was for a little while. He came for a specific purpose, and that was to taste death for every man. Second objection. Okay, so if he tasted death for every man, that doesn't sound very superior or very glorious or very, how shall we say, better. If Jesus was going to come to earth, why did he come in such a humble way? And Jesus didn't come at his first coming in a way that just blew everyone off, and they were blew everyone away. They said, wow, this guy is something else. He's amazing. He wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. They looked at him. They looked down on him. Isn't this the carpenter? Even his own family said, we know you. You're just Jesus. Isaiah 53 says, we didn't even look at him. He wasn't anything. There was no form or appearance of anything good in him. And we just didn't even have anything to do with him. He came in a humbled way. So how is that superior to angels? And he says, I'm glad you asked. Let's talk about that. Verse 10, it was fitting. It was appropriate. It was right. This was a good thing. All right. Say again, this was a good thing that Jesus came in this humble way. How we're trying to tell our family and friends, you should believe in Jesus, he's the Messiah, and they're like, wasn't he the guy that died on the cross? That doesn't sound like a Messiah to me. That sounds like someone who was under God's curse, right? And he says this, it was fitting, this was right, this was good, that he, for whom and by whom all things exist,
the God of the universe, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. He says this, God made Jesus perfect through suffering. Now, he's not saying that Jesus was imperfect and he had to fix him up and so this is what he did, but he's saying he made the son's experience complete. Right? He didn't say to his son, no one could say about Jesus, well, Jesus, yeah, I mean, he was a human being, but, I mean, give me a break. I mean, he lived like God's son. It's kind of like, and I don't know if this is really true, but, you have the British monarchs and their sons, the two sons, they are serving in the armed forces, right? Or they have served in the armed forces. I can't imagine that they would send those guys out into, here's the crown prince. Hey, go fly a helicopter into a combat mission. I have to think that they would say, you're not on this one, okay? This is actually dangerous, so, the cameras aren't here. We got to protect you, all right? But Jesus he's sent into the most dangerous position of all. God sends him as his son, his messenger to his world that he created, and they reject him, and they don't have anything to do with him, and they turn their backs on him, and they ultimately kill him. And he says, this is fitting. It made the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. His suffering made his human experience complete. Because how can you say, I know what it's like to be a human if you've never suffered? I mean, the human experience is that's pretty much a big part of it. And if you're young and idealistic, I hate to burst your bubble, but there's a lot of suffering that's involved in being a human being. Because we live in a sinful world. And even if we don't sin, other people's sin affects us and hurts us. And there's sickness and there's death. And Jesus experienced that. And he experienced this complete human experience because he suffered. Now think about the people to whom the writer is writing. He's writing to people who are going through suffering. And they're saying, oh, if I could just get away from Jesus, then I could get away from this suffering. And he's saying, Jesus came to earth and he suffered and he knows what it's like. You're not turning your back on some crown prince who has no idea what you're going through. He says, he made the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Verse 11, he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. I don't think that's a great translation. I prefer the one in the footnotes there, are all of one. He says this, they're one and the same. Jesus is not saying, okay, now you guys are, go ahead and suffer for me. I appreciate that. And that would be right. That would be good. He is God. And if he wanted us to suffer for him, then that would be so. But he says, I'm in the trenches with you. I've been there. I've suffered. I've had the complete human experience. He says, the one who sanctifies us, we're all in this together. He says, that is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. Jesus doesn't say, yeah, those are my minions, those are my people, those are my servants, those are my slaves. He says, these are my brothers. I think that's a huge statement about how we ought to view Christians who are being persecuted. If Jesus isn't ashamed to call us his brothers, we shouldn't be ashamed to call one another brothers either. He says, those are my people. Those are my brothers. I know what they're going through. I've been there. I've done that. And the writer of Hebrews says, you're suffering and you're thinking, oh, if I can get away from Jesus, I'll get away from your suffering. And Jesus said, I went toward the suffering so that I could call you my brothers. He says, he's not ashamed to call them brothers. He quotes from the Psalms there. I will tell of your name to my brothers. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children God has given me. This is in a diminutive sense. He's saying, these are the children. We're part of a family here. These are the children that God has given to me. So here's his conclusion, verse 14. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, what is it that your children all have in common? Well, we're flesh and blood, right? We're part of the family. We share in flesh and blood. Jesus said, I'm part of your family. I'm part of the human family. I've been there. I've suffered. He himself likewise partook of the same things. He shared. They shared in flesh and blood, and he shared in the things that we share in, and that is suffering and persecution and death. And Jesus said, I'm in it. I'm in it with you. I share in that as well. And in so doing, look at verse 14, he says, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil. He shatters the devil's power over him and over us. Because what is it that the devil has over all of us? Sin, the reign of sin, and ultimately death. And Jesus shatters that, just breaks that. Because Jesus comes into this world, suffers, and breaks the power of sin and death. And he says, these people, my brothers, they're with me. They're with me. And he breaks the power of death, that is the devil, and he delivers those, verse 15, through fear of death, were subject to lifelong slavery. He gives us new life and he breaks that power of death. Verse 16, for surely it's not angels that he helps. He didn't come to save angels. All right, the angels who disobeyed, the angels who rebelled, 2 Peter chapter 2 says they're already in hell waiting their future destination. They don't have a second chance. They don't get a redeemer. And the ones who are confirmed in holiness, they don't need one. All right. But for those of us, for human beings, Jesus came and became one of us. He called us his brothers. He said, I'm part of this family. And he came and he suffered so that he might destroy the power of death over us and that he might help us. For surely it's not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. And to these people, he would be speaking very literally, the offspring of Abraham, Hebrews. I think the application is to us, similar to what he says in Galatians, where he says the people who have the faith like Abraham had. Abraham believed and it was counted to him for righteousness, so we believe and it's counted to us for righteousness. He says he comes to help us. He came to help us. Verse 17, therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God. Right? And he's going to go on to on this theme much more in depth. But he says, Jesus then becomes this perfect, amazing high priest. He can represent us to God. And he knows what it's like. He has suffered with us. He has suffered everything. His experience was complete. It was perfect in every way in all that suffering. He might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God. He's merciful toward us, and he's faithful in relationship to God. He's absolutely the perfect priest. He's the perfect go-between between human beings and God. And he says he does that in order to make propitiation for the sins of the people. That's what a priest did. He took sacrifices that made it so that they could be right with God. And that's what Jesus did. He offered a sacrifice, although not continually like the under the Old Testament law, but once and for all, which is his big point when he comes to chapter 9. He made a sacrifice. He offered himself so that we might be right with God, a propitiating sacrifice there. Here's his conclusion in verse 18 then. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. We could use the word tempted. It might be more helpful to even put in tested. Jesus suffered and was tested. He knows what it's like. He's on our side. He says, those are my brothers. Those are my people. I'm here to help them as a merciful and faithful high priest as we're being tested and as we're undergoing temptation. Now, let's take that. Let's take that thought. And you say, well, that's not really a conclusion. Well, it's not really the conclusion of Hebrews either. But we're gonna get there, and we could even see, even in our memory verses, which give those conclusions, that we, since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, and let us hold fast the confession of our hope. Those are things that we could certainly add to those.